Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN, and I'm nervous because on the afternoon show that I do on Sunday afternoon, we talked about the gold medal hockey team, a women's team and the men's team, and, well, I talked to the king of hockey, Hall of Fame broadcaster Doc Emmerich, who, when he speaks, it's poetry, and he said, "I listen to you every Sunday morning." Now I'm nervous. Wouldn't you be? Doc Emmerich is listening, so I have to really be good this morning. I will try my best. I have on the phone Sarah Ruan, Associate Curator of Herpetology and the Director of Core Laboratories. We're going to talk about reptiles at the Field Museum of Natural History. And through April 5, this special exhibit is happening. Good morning, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much. I mean, this exhibit, I wonder what motivated the Field Museum to say, let's focus on reptiles.
So what I can tell you as far as some background is that the Field Museum has a super long history of herpetology and research on reptiles and amphibians going far back before my time there. And we had this amazing hall of reptiles that, due to some renovations that are occurring, has to be torn down. And when the plans for that went into effect, I was approached by the exhibits team saying, hey, you know, we've wanted to do something with live animals for a while. Would you be interested in working with us in order to put together an exhibit on reptiles? And maybe we could do some live reptiles as part of it. And I said, absolutely.
And I want to talk about reptiles as pets, but before I do, I want to ask you about a legendary, I'm sure you know his name, herpetologist at the Field Museum, who ended up being killed by a snake, a boonslang snake, as I recall.
Yes.
Yeah, tell me about
you've
that.
You've got it. So Carl Schmidt was one of the first curators of herpetology that the Field Museum had. And unfortunately, after he retired, so he was already emeritus. He was no longer an actual employed curator, but like many scientists, could not stop coming to work, to his misfortune, actually. He was in his office one day when the Lincoln Park Zoo had sent down a snake that they weren't sure how to identify it, that they had gotten from, I assume, a shipment of animals from somewhere in Africa. And he was asked to identify the snake. He takes it out of the bag that it's in. He's taking a look at it, and it bites him on the finger. And he had realized somewhat quickly that it was, in fact, a juvenile boonslang. One thing to note about juvenile snakes is they don't always look quite the same as an adult, so they can be pretty hard to identify. And so Schmidt realized quickly after the fact that he, you know, this wasn't going to be a good thing, but it was also poorly known at the time that boonslangs were necessarily super dangerous, or at least medically dangerous. And so what Schmidt ended up doing was taking extensive notes on how he was feeling, what the symptoms were, what the effects of the bite were. He went home, he took the train home, he lived in Homewood, and kept a diary of everything that happened to him after the fact. And the diary, there's a beautiful reading online, if you were to Google it, of the diary, and it's pretty rough stuff. It was gang bit by a boonslang, causes a lot of bleeding from orifices. And unfortunately, the next morning after he had eaten breakfast, he was still taking notes in his journal, but by the time he was found later that day by his wife, he had already passed away.
Can you imagine just being bitten by that particular species of snake and then just taking the train home?
Yeah, I can't actually, because I know how bad it would be.
Yeah, exactly. But he's kind of a hero for being a scientist to the very end.
Absolutely. He's well known for this journal. It was published after the fact, posthumously. And he's also known as an amazing herpetologist outside of all of the sort of sensationalism around his death as well.
All right. So now I want to ask you the big question, the most controversial question anyone can ask. And a question I wouldn't have asked 20 years ago or even 15 or 10 years ago, maybe. Are birds reptiles?
Absolutely.
Oh, she's definitive.
I would say it's not even controversial. They're not the best reptiles or my favorite reptiles or even considered part of the field of herpetology, which historically excludes birds. But birds are, from an evolutionary standpoint, absolutely reptiles.
So I can think of the cassowary in New Zealand or Australia. Yeah, that's like a velociraptor. How do you say that?
Yeah, like a velociraptor.
Yeah.
They look like a dinosaur.
Yeah. So I get that. And if you look up those birds, I mean, their claws can literally kill a person. And I believe that's happened. I can think of a bird called the Howitzin, I believe, that lives along the river, the Amazon basin. And they're very, very, I mean, you're looking at a dinosaur. So I could see that. But on the other hand, let me argue, birds have feathers and also they are warm-blooded. So how do you counter those arguments?
So having feathers is just another form of doing something with keratin. So the scales on reptiles, as well as the hair on mammals, are keratin-based structures. So there's nothing really special about having a specialized keratin structure, because we have them as mammals as hair, birds have them as feathers. Birds also, if you look at their legs, are quite scaly. So they also have scales just like other reptiles. And reptiles themselves have these specialized keratin structures, which do differ amongst different groups of reptiles. The shell of a turtle is a keratinized structure that has a bony underlying, but similarly, the scales on a snake are also a keratinized structure. And so keratin itself is found across all these groups of animals. In addition, being warm-blooded, also not special to birds, because mammals, of course, are warm-blooded as well and are not closely related to birds. They're not nearly as close as dinosaurs or other reptiles are to birds. And in addition, there are some other reptiles and dinosaurs that are not what we would consider cold-blooded or fully ectothermic, that are able to generate body heat in some capacity. So it's more of a generality when we talk about reptiles being cold-blooded. But birds, of course, are actually warm-blooded. So you can have differences, but still be more closely related to reptiles versus something like mammals.
Oh, more closely related, but that doesn't make them reptiles.
From an evolutionary standpoint, it absolutely does.
So you are suggesting I lose the argument.
I mean, we could continue having a lovely discussion about it, but birds do originate from dinosaurs, which are well embedded in the reptile family. So we would consider them reptiles, even if they're not as reptilian in nature from their outward appearance.
When we come back, we'll talk more about reptiles alive, and I will ask Sarah about a reptile or two or three, if you can get one as a pet, what to choose. And we'll do that when we come back on WGN. Shame on me. I just learned Sarah Ruan is a doctor. Dr. Sarah Ruan, Associate Curator of Herpetology and Director of Core Laboratories at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. The exhibit is called Reptiles Alive, and it runs through April 5th. Tell me a bit about the exhibit.
So this exhibit combines what I would call classic museum dioramas, specimens, models, information, along with some live reptiles. Because people, including myself, what gets people excited a lot of the time is seeing live living animals. And while I like seeing them out in nature the most, seeing them in a museum setting or in a zoo can also be a pretty wonderful experience, especially for the younger audience.
Indeed, and you do have a variety of there, including a alligator, at least a dwarf alligator.
Yeah, we've actually got two. We've got a dwarf crocodile and also a baby American alligator.
Okay.
So we've got both crocodiles and alligators in that exhibit.
And there is a difference between the two that the diagrams and such tell you about and you have, I forget the iguana's name.
Guanji. Yeah.
Yes. So there are many species of iguana. We think, well, we go down to Mexico or somewhere, and or even in parts of the United States and Florida.
Yeah, you just go to Florida.
Yeah, yeah, really. And you see the green iguana, I believe, is the species. But there are many species, and this one is important because this is an endangered species.
Yes, absolutely. So among a lot of the islands in the Caribbean, every single island, and sometimes even the surrounding islands, have their own species of iguana that's pretty much isolated from the other populations, which means over time it becomes distinct and really doesn't interact with other populations, thus being its own species. And so this Cuban rock iguana is one of those species.
And also, the iguanas can be, and I want you to talk about this, they can be, if you do the right thing, but it's not easy to do the right thing is the problem for these animals. And a good pet in some ways. I don't know how you feel about that. How do you feel?
So I will agree 100%. Iguanas can make excellent pets if they're handled a lot. As young, they are captive bred at this point, and so you're not decimating wild populations if you were to get one. The biggest issue with iguanas is they usually get pretty big, and you can't underestimate the amount of space and specialized care that they need. They can make great pets, and they can be interested in hanging out with people. Guanji, the Cuban rock iguana, is extremely personable. He's a really charismatic lizard, but they really do need a lot more space as they mature than most people are able to provide. They also, most reptiles need pretty good heat sources and pretty good lighting. And they're not just your standard light bulb. You're going to need lights that really mimic the sun. And they can be kind of expensive. And so it's not as straightforward as you get a 10-gallon aquarium and you put this iguana in it and all is good. They do need pretty specialized care, but that doesn't mean they make bad pets. It just means they're a little more time and sometimes monetarily intense than people expect.
And space. If you think about it, if you climb and you're 6 feet long as an adult,
you need a lot of space.
Exactly. You need, literally a room in my
opinion. You need
opinion.
A room. Yeah, you really do.
Yep.
You need a whole room, a greenhouse. If you happen to have greenhouse abilities on your property, that really is an ideal circumstance for an animal like that.
All right. So given that's, it can be done is what you're saying, but it's not for everyone.
Yes.
What might be a good reptile with training wheels, a starting reptile?
So great reptiles, especially if you like lizards, are going to be leopard geckos. For one example, they don't get too big. You can handle them. They're very docile and gentle. The downside for a lot of people with something like a leopard gecko, and again, they're captive bred. They're relatively inexpensive. They can do pretty well in a 20-gallon aquarium for their entire life, but they do eat live insects. And so you're going to be beholden to your trips to your local pet store to get crickets or mealworms or other insect food for the lifetime of this animal. And reptiles live typically a pretty long time. You aren't getting something that's going to be around for only 2 or 3 years. Most reptiles are going to live at least 10 to 15 years, and a lot of them can live 60, 70, or 80 years. And so the lifespan of the animal is something that you always are going to want to consider as well, even if the animal itself is quite easy to care for. But leopard geckos are a great beginner lizard. Now, for people who are interested in something a little more exciting, there are also a lot of snakes that make excellent pets. Snakes are what I especially love and what I study in my research program. And a couple of snakes that I always recommend when people want to get a snake, which I would say is far easier than a lizard.
Can I guess? Okay. How about a corn snake? Is that what you're going to say?
Perfect.
Okay.
Corn snakes always one of my top three. They come in a huge variety of different color morphs. So there's all sorts of crazy color combos that you can get. They will almost always eat already dead mice, which you can buy a 24-pack of mice and put them in your freezer and you're set for the next year. Very, very easy. If you need to go on vacation, you know, for a week, snake's probably okay being by itself. You don't need a pet sitter. And then if you wanted something, the one thing about corn snakes and similar snakes like milk snakes and king snakes is that they're really easy to take care of. They don't get too big usually, but they're a little more active in how they move around than some other snakes, which means if you take one out and you think you're going to sit there with it on your lap while you watch TV, it might have other ideas. It's going to want to go explore. It's going to be pretty active. And that's not a bad thing. But conversely, something like a ball python, which is my number one pick as a pet snake, and I have had one for 36 years now myself.
Wow.
So I'm well versed in ball pythons, and they do live a long time. They can live well over 50 years. But ball pythons are great because they're a little bit slower moving. Similarly, despite being a python, they only get about 4 or 5, very rarely up to 6 feet long, which for a snake is not that large. Very easy to handle, very docile. Again, you can feed them mice or small rats that are already pre-killed, and you get them frozen in a package, thaw them out once every couple of weeks, feed them. And those snakes, because of their lifestyle, which is they are a sit-and-wait predator, they're pretty happy to kind of just sit around with you if you want to handle them. The one that I've had for the last 30-plus years is a real ambassador of snakes. He's come with me to a lot of different outreach programs, met a lot of school kids, even preschool classes, and he is really, really, really easy, nice, never does anything aggressive. And so I always, my corn snakes are great, but if I had to pick just one pet snake, it would be a ball python.
You know, a six pack of mice, you said? You know,
yeah.
I'm only a little concerned because I know the price of eggs has stabilized. I'm not sure about the price of prepacked mice. I guess
Not that much. Maybe depending on how big of a pack you buy, just like many things, the higher the quantity, the lower the cost per individual item. And so you're only talking, you could feed a snake, an average-sized snake like a corn snake or a ball python, for under $30 a year.
I want to see the mother-in-law's face when she opens the fridge and finds the frozen mice in there.
Yeah, we had to get a separate freezer at my house for keeping. I also pick up a lot of roadkill along with keeping mice in my freezer.
Okay, I think we'll stop it there.
I bring those roadkill animals into the museum for being preserved. And so, yeah, my freezer is not for the faint at heart.
Sarah Ruan, Associate Curator, Herpetology, Field Museum, Reptiles Alive through April 5. Thank you so much. So it's raining, or it's snowing. Hopefully it's not snowing. Not too much anymore, we hope. And the dog is going stir crazy inside the house, but so are the kids. What do you do? Well, there are all sorts of indoor games and activities that can be played with dogs, and most of these with cats, too. One is hide and seek. So you start by, and this is the greatest thing ever, it's some exercise for the dog. The dog gets to use its nose. Dogs love the opportunity to do that. And it can keep the kids busy if they're doing it. It enhances the human-animal bond. So what happens is this. You start by having the kids or a child or yourself stand maybe 5-6 feet in front of the dog, but you've got a treat in your hand. You show the dog the treat. The dog may smell the treat, and you say, "Come, Snoopy," and Snoopy comes because the dog sees you. The dog smells the treat. The dog, of course, is going to come. But then over time, tell the dog sit, stay, and go further and further away each time, eventually around the corner into a room. So now whoever is doing it is hiding. Maybe the kids are doing it, and they're actually coming up with creative places to hide. And you have to enforce the sit-stay so the dog doesn't cheat and run ahead. No, they have to wait, and then the kids hide under a bed, in a shower stall, wherever, behind a closet door. And I can assure you, or your money back, that dog is going to find you. I love snuffle mats. You have to buy these, or not necessarily. They can be a DIY project. They typically consist of rubber or a fabric base covered with dozens, sometimes maybe even 100 or more, soft fleece strips. And what you do is you scatter kibble, cat or dog treats, or cat or dog food in those strips, and the dog or cat will sniff them out, kind of move around those strips and find it. It's a way for the animal to forage. And this is actually good mental exercise. The only caveat is for puppies or for kittens, potentially, I don't want them to eat the fabric. So you have to be careful of that if you have a puppy or kitten. Who doesn't get an Amazon box? You know what they're really for? They're for our pets. For dogs or for cats especially, put out an empty box, it becomes a home for a cat. But even a better home if there are sometimes treats inside. Move the box around different places around the house. It becomes an altogether new play area. Sprinkle some catnip inside the box or the packing paper that comes. You could sprinkle treats in there too. Many more ideas on my website. Check it out at stevedale.tv. Steve Weaver is the Senior Director of Community Impact at Anti-Cruelty. Anti-Cruelty has several unique services, and one of those services I think is particularly important and is not spoken about often enough because it's a difficult topic to talk about, and that's a pet loss support line and pet loss support group. Steve, this has been around a long time at Anti-Cruelty, hasn't it?
Yes, it's been running for over 10 years, and it's called Working Through Pet Loss, and it's a pet loss support group that we run via Zoom.
You know, people who don't have pets or haven't had pets may not understand, yeah, it's a dog or it's a cat, but the dog or cat is a member of the family. And I would suggest sometimes, in some ways, the loss for some people may be more profound than you losing a human family member. Have you found that to be the case?
I mean, pets are part of our family. They're also provide us with unconditional love. You know, they don't argue with us usually. So people really get connected to them. So when they're when they pass away, it's a huge loss. And sometimes people diminish that and like, oh, it was just a dog or just a cat. But really, it was an important support, especially for a lot of our older residents in the community. And so this provides a place for them to be able to process that.
Older residents, yes, absolutely. And I would add children on as well. Are children able to participate in this in some way?
It's geared towards adults.
Do you have adults that participate, but are there asking questions like, how do I tell my kids?
Absolutely. It is the whole family is grieving. So I think it can be a place for parents to be able to learn tools, to be able to talk about it and feel they're not alone, and then help their child process that grief also.
All right, so let's start at square one here. You've sadly have suffered a loss. What is the next step? What do people do? How do people find you, and how does it work?
Yeah, the class meets twice a month online from 6 to 7:30, and you would go to our website, anticruelty.org. Under events, you'll be able to sign up for the pet loss support group, and it'll show you the time and the day. And then you would be sent a Zoom link, and then you would join the group virtually.
How many are typically in the group at a time?
Yeah, it's usually a group of either 5 to 10 at the most, usually, of different people. And, it's accessible, it's free, and we really see it as a resource for people who may not otherwise have access to mental health support.
And what time of day did you say this happens?
6 to 7:30.
And I want to point out that Central Time, and I'm pointing that out because I understand you've had people from all over the country and, in fact, all over the world participate.
We have Japan, Vietnam, Jamaica, and I think it just shows there's a universal love for animals and a need to be able to process when they do leave us.
What is the most common concern, if that's the right word, that you hear?
I think in general it's people who are just trying to be able to express what happened with other supportive people. Someone who also had a pet, also went through that loss. That's the beauty of having a group there, because often in grief, we feel isolated, whether it's a human that we're grieving or a pet. Other people move on, and you still are left with that grief. And so I think the most common thing is you want to just be around other people who understand.
You know, the thing that I've heard most often about this is that you have to find an outlet. So this can be the outlet or a outlet. The other outlets may vary. Some people write in a journal about your animal. Some people are, not me, but some people are artistic. Maybe draw pictures or tell your kids to do that. Is that the kind of thing you recommend?
Yeah, I think finding some way that you can honor that pet's part of your life and be able to allow that process to happen. Because for some people it's quick, and other people it takes a long time. Or it comes up on different times of the year when you connected with that person or that pet was a part of something special in your life.
I remember I was on at a different time of day. This was many years ago. And someone called into the show, as we took phone calls back then, and someone called into the show and said, and went on about a cat that he lost, and on. I mean, this person was hurting. And I said, well, when did this happen that your cat passed away? Just in conversation. And he said, I think it was 9 years ago. And now first he's talking about that. Have you had people join the group whose loss is not, maybe doesn't go back that far, but is not as recent as one might think?
Well, we had a member who said we could share her story. Her name is Brer, and her dog, she adopted it young, and it was just, you know, a companion with her. She called it her twin. They walked down the aisle together because the dog was a dog of honor at her wedding. I mean, it was just a real bond. And then the dog passed away at 8 very suddenly. And she found our group, and she's been participating for a while, over a year. And wow. I think grief takes different times and different, amounts of time for you to be able to process it. So, and now she's in the group and become someone who's supporting other people, you know, through that process.
Hmm. Anti-Cruelty does a great thing here. The Pet Loss Support Group, Steve Weber, the senior director of Community Impact, and we'll be back on WGN. At Anti-Cruelty, it's Steve Weber. We're talking about pet loss. And this is an issue that I think almost should be talked about more often. And it's not your happy, upbeat radio interview, but if you have a companion animal, it is something likely you will experience. And for many have experienced over and over and over, which is my next question, Steve. Does it get any easier?
The loss of a pet, does it get any easier? I don't think so. We work with a lot of older adults, and we sometimes supply them with food or access to veterinary care, and we help them through the loss of their pet also. And I think when you're more isolated in society and your pet is that companion for maybe a spouse that no longer is there, you know, it can be really hard to be able to go through that. But then again, when you're older in life, you have more wisdom, but it can be a huge loss.
Our earlier segment was on the Field Museum of Natural History exhibit, Reptiles Alive. So I will ask you, have you had people that participate? Because the human-animal bond does really exist in other animals beyond dogs and cats. Have you had people that have participated that have said, Harry, my iguana, I lost my iguana a year ago, passed away, or not a year ago, a few days ago, passed away. And then how do other people respond?
Yeah. Now, the group is run by a professional grief counselor, and Yvette Camacho. And so she's the one who actually facilitates the group. But I am sure over 10 years, there has been more than cats and dogs, because that's what we have here at Anti-Cruelty. We have mainly cats and dogs, but we have rabbits and recently some rats who came in. And, you know, everyone has their bond. Rats are not mine, but some people it is.
Well, rats are actually, we're not talking about the rats you see in an alley. That is a different kind of rat. Domestic rats, the most heartbreaking part of it, because they are so interactive, because they are so intelligent. The hardest part is that they do only live a year or two.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah. I'm not an expert on that.
Okay. What I just said is the case. So people have this intense bond, and they sadly go so fast. And when there are kids involved, that makes it even more difficult. So I suppose mom and dad do their best with that 18-year-old dog to prepare the kids for what may ultimately happen, because the dog is now has cancer or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. But what about the sudden loss of a pet? Is that in some ways more difficult, not only for kids, for sure, for kids, I would assume, but also for adults?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it when they've been such a companion there every day, and you don't, you know, my own dog is getting up there in age, and my kids were young when he joined our family, and now they're out of the house. And, you know, we all are kind of preparing for the fact that this is going to happen in the next, you know, while. But if he would have been lost much younger, you know, it can be a traumatic thing. And that's why it's so great to be able to have a group where you can share that. Someone else might have gone through a similar thing, and you're able to see that, I'm not alone. This is a universal feeling, and you can start that process of working through it.
How emotional are people on this Zoom call? Are people guarded, or do people mostly, you see their grief?
Yvette has done an incredible job, and she is a professional because she's able to be trained to be able to deal with it. But I think you have people who are exactly guarded and maybe are a little nervous about joining a group like this, and other people who let the tears flow, and it provides a very, you know, a place where they can cry and not feel safe doing so, and not judged because they're crying about their pet, which some people might not understand if you've never had that bond.
I know it's not a dating app, Steve, but people there all do have something in common. Have people hooked up that are a part of this group?
I don't, you know, that's a good question. I don't know of any relationships or that have blossomed out of the group, but that's a very good question.
But they can be there week after week, so I suspect that at least some have gone out for coffee or something. Or something, and it's not for me or you to judge what that something is. Now, I would think that the toughest losses in some ways might be, and you alluded to this earlier, for seniors in particular, whose only companionship in many cases might be, especially through the pandemic, might have been a dog or a cat. Have you found that to be the case?
We deal and are connected to, like I said, a number of seniors, providing them with food or pet care. And the way they talk about their pets, especially during COVID, because that's when then we were, you know, connecting with them. Pets play such an important role in companionship, in allowing them to care for someone, especially if they lost a spouse. And we really want to get the word out to people who may not have that extended network that other older adults do, so that they can connect to this group and be able to, you know, find that support.
Yeah. How can people find the support? If they're interested in this pet loss support group, where do they go, Steve?
They can go to anticruelty.org. Under events, you will see pet loss support. When it meets, you sign up and you'll get a link to Zoom, and that's how you'll be able to join.
Yeah, and the service is absolutely free, and it's a very important service. Steve Weaver, Director of Community Impact at Anti-Cruelty, thank you so much. This is amazing news for cats. So some of you that are long-time listeners might remember a cat that I had named Ricky, who was a TV star at the time because Ricky played the piano, a little kid's piano, and he did much more than that, all these tricks. But Ricky suddenly died of what's called feline hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in 2001 and 2002 because there was no treatment for that, not really. We didn't even know much about this very common disease in cats. I began a fund with the Wynn Feline Foundation, now called the Every Cat Health Foundation. Same organization funds cat health studies. And now there is a drug, the first drug ever, that treats the disease rather than the symptoms of the disease. It's called Felicin CA1. Lots more information about that on my website. And it's great news, stevedale.tv. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.